I'm Montse Alvarado. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, facing questions, President Biden meets the press for roughly an hour last night, and reaction is pouring in. We have team coverage. Meeting in Milwaukee. Final preparations are in place for the Republican National Convention. We have a preview. Push for peace. New developments in the efforts for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. And gone but not forgotten, how a conference in Germany is honoring the memory of Pope Benedict XVI. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. I'm Montse Alvarado in for Tracy Sable. Our top story tonight, President Joe Biden returns to the campaign trail with a trip to the Midwest. Just last night, he tried repairing the damage done to his reelection bid after that debate debacle. He said last night he wants to complete the job he started and promised to beat Donald Trump again. But a couple of his big gaffes are under the proverbial spotlight. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen?
Monse, tonight, President Joe Biden is holding a campaign event in Michigan, part of the trio of blue wall states his campaign now says is the clearest path to winning re-election. Meanwhile, every time he now speaks or misspeaks, his comments are under intense scrutiny.
President Joe Biden back out courting voters. The latest stop, Detroit, aiming to boost enthusiasm for his campaign and solidify support for Michigan's prominent Democratic leaders. Just hours earlier, holding a solo news conference, the president fielding questions from reporters from a pre-selected list.
With that, I'll take your questions. I've been given a list of people to call on here.
It didn't start well, flubbing the name of his own vice president.
Look, I wouldn't have picked Vice President Trump to be vice president, but I think she was not qualified to be president. So let's start there.
Later, at the end of the news conference, a reporter asked him about that mix-up.
Earlier you misspoke in your opening answer and you referred to Vice President Harris as Vice President Trump. Right now, Donald Trump is using that to mock your age and your memory. How do you combat that criticism from tonight?
Listen to him.
This concludes tonight's press conference.
And at a NATO event Thursday with world leaders, the president making this miscue.
And now I want to hand it over to the president of Ukraine, who has as much courage as he has determination. Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin. President Putin. You're going to beat President Putin. President Zelensky. I'm so focused on beating Putin, we got to worry about it. Anyway, Mr. President.
I'm better.
You are a hell of a lot better.
Meanwhile, people in the president's own party continue to worry about him.
I don't know what his aides are telling him, but he's in a very tough spot right now to win this election. And if they're not telling him that, they're doing a disservice to him.
Early next week, the president travels to Texas to mark the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act and to Nevada to speak at the NAACP convention. But the spotlight could shift to former President Donald Trump when the Republican National Convention gets underway from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
As the president campaigned in Michigan today, more Democratic lawmakers are calling for him to get out of the race. Their actions are putting pressure on House Democratic leaders to give the president that message. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with the latest. Eric, what's going on the Hill?
Well, I tell you what, Monse, the drum is definitely beating louder. The president had barely finished his news conference last night when three more House Democrats called on him to end his campaign, joining nearly two dozen who had already done so. Some like Congressman Jim Himes, the lead Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, tells me that the president needs to drop out in order for Democrats to keep control of the House.
The hard reality is, and I'm far from the only Democrat who believes this, that the numbers, the trajectory, what Americans feel in their bones right now suggest not only that Joe Biden would lose this race, but that he or we would lose the Senate and the House.
Others agree it's time for a change.
We can't have a situation where every day we're holding our breath, whether it's a press conference, a debate, or a rally. And I think we're at a historic moment where the president can pass the torch to the next generation, not only unite the Democratic Party, but unite the country.
Democrats who want to support President Biden say that they were encouraged by his leadership at the NATO meeting and his performance at last night's news conference.
Biden promised that this press conference is just the beginning of, or a continuation of, his efforts to try to put the June 27th debate behind us. And I think he's got more to do, but he took an important step tonight.
Senator Chris Coons says his colleagues are simply overreacting and getting all the attention.
10% or less of House Democrats raising questions don't deserve the same coverage as the 90% of House Democrats who are saying that Joe Biden is going to be our nominee.
But some Senate Republicans worry that President Biden is jeopardizing national security.
This needs to stop. I'm tired of being told there's nothing wrong with Joe Biden. Do you want him in a room with Putin or Xi? I wouldn't let the guy buy me a car. I've known the guy. I like him, but he's compromised.
So what happens if the president drops out? Congressman James Clyburn says he's confident Vice President Kamala Harris can do the job.
Absolutely. No question about that. She has acquitted herself well in the job as vice president. And he never would have picked her in the first place if he did not think that she was capable of being president.
House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries says that he's been communicating with his members, and he even met privately with President Biden last night. Lawmakers tell me that they simply want to put this all behind them as quickly as possible while the attention turns to the Republican National Convention, which begins on Monday. Monse?
Thank you so much, Eric. Now to the war in the Middle East, where Israel sends a delegation to expand ceasefire talks with Hamas. Amid the push for peace, Israel presses ahead with its offensive across various areas of Gaza. Locals have returned to devastated areas of Gaza City following a two-week offensive. But there are signs of hope. There are increased calls from protesters for a ceasefire deal that would include the release of the remaining hostages. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, including party planners. The Republican convention starts next week in Milwaukee. We have a preview. And part two of my interview with the head of the Knights of Columbus about the decision to cover up mosaics done by Father Marco Rupnik. We mentioned earlier, the Republican National Convention begins Monday in Milwaukee. Former President Donald Trump is set to be the party's nominee for the third time. The gathering in Milwaukee comes with the former president leading in many polls and Democrats in disarray amid questions over Joe Biden. The convention features 2,400 delegates. Speakers include Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. The former president is also set to unveil his running mate. With the preview of the GOP convention, we turn to Lisa Camuso-Miller, host of the Friday Reporter podcast and the former communications director for the Republican National Committee. Lisa, great to be with you. First off, what should we expect from the Republican convention? What are some of the highlights and some of the questions?
Well, you know, I think that the biggest challenge for the Republican National Convention going into next week is the way that the nominee will have to identify and connect with the various audiences that still have questions about whether or not they can support him. Certainly everyone in the room is excited and ready for him to take back the White House, but there are pockets of voters that still have questions. And so I think if the Republican National Convention is smart, and I know they will be, they'll be identifying and sharing speakers that can speak to a variety of different audiences so that they can really connect with those who maybe still have questions about whether or not they can be in favor of the president.
Now, one of the looming questions and the points of criticism that have been most significant are the pro-lifers. Their pushback over the Republican platform and the changes there after a lot of the language on fighting abortion was removed. What role will abortion play in the convention? And is there a chance the pro-life language would be put back in the official platform at some point?
You know, so here's the thing about that. I think that what voters and those who have a position about life can be confident in is that the party has demonstrated exactly how they are and where they stand on the issue. And I think that what we saw with the change in the language of the platform was really a way for the party to try to thread the needle with not only those who are very strongly and pro-life, but those who perhaps see this as an issue that is one that they could be otherwise with the party, but that there's some room for discussion. And also, by the way, don't forget that the true pillars of the Republican Party are the power of the states and the power of the states having the ability to make those choices and make those decisions.
Well, former President Trump has been relatively quiet on who will be his running mate. That will also be significant for the life movement. What are you hearing? And should we expect an announcement at the convention?
Oh, I definitely think you'll be hearing something very soon. In fact, I would be surprised if we didn't know something by very early next week. You know, I think that the president and the folks that are around him have been very smart about trying to identify candidates that not only bring a different voice and a different perspective, but also that have a true connection to the values that the party really still considers to be very, very important. So while I wish I knew, and I'm not sure that anybody other than former President Trump knows who the choice will be. I do think, though, that he will pick someone that will be not only bright and smart about the issues, but also someone that's from perhaps a different part of the country. As much as I love to see Marco Rubio as someone that's being talked about, Senator Rubio is someone who also shares the same state as the former president. So those folks that are the odds makers in that game, I think, are saying that it's more likely that we'll see someone like a J.D. Vance or someone that's in another state that perhaps can bring a different point of view and different perspective to the conversation.
Lisa Camuso Miller, host of the Friday Reporter podcast, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
In an exclusive interview with EWTN, the head of the Knights of Columbus made a major announcement. Supreme Knight Patrick Kelly revealed the mosaics created by accused abuser Father Marco Rupnik will be covered up at the John Paul II Shrine in Washington, D.C., and the Knights' headquarters in Connecticut. The Jesuits expelled Father Rupnik in June of 2023 after allegations of highly credible serial spiritual, psychological, and sexual abuse. It's the strongest public stand yet by a major Catholic organization regarding the former Jesuits' embattled art. In the second part of my interview with Supreme Knight Patrick Kelly, I asked him if he thought other organizations should follow suit in this decision.
That's a great question. I mean, our decision was a decision we made for the Knights of Columbus and the John Paul II Shrine in the unique context of the United States, right? And the United States has been rocked with sexual abuse. I can't say our decision applies to other shrines, other churches. But I would say, and I would hope that perhaps other shrines and other locations can get guidance and maybe assistance from the process that we went through. And I would say the message I would say to them is that whatever they decide, I would say do two things. Have wide consultations and talk to victims and learn from victims because they can bring clarity to an often confusing environment. As you know, Monsi, there's a lot of noise out there with regard to this, but if you really get down to it, it is about furthering the mission of the location and the mission of the church.
Your plan to cover the artwork for now is both vague and concrete in that you're going to use fabric to cover the mosaics and then eventually maybe consider covering them in plaster. And you mentioned that you're deferring to the Vatican's decision on Rupnik's sexual abuse cases. Was the cost of this and the idea of investing financial resources that you use for charity in covering up the art a significant factor in your considerations or deliberations about how to move forward?
There obviously is a cost involved here. But when we looked at this, we really decided, you know, we needed to do the right thing above all else. And the cost was secondary. So while it was a factor, we had other factors that weighed more heavily than the cost.
What might you replace it with? Have you considered that at all?
Yeah, we don't know if we get to that point where we cover it permanently. We would engage in a very thoughtful process of discernment on what we would cover it with. But obviously, it would have to be art that would lift the heart to God, but also be in keeping with the legacy of John Paul II, and because that's really the mission of the John Paul II Shrine.
How does having the artwork there contradict the mission of the shrine?
Well, I think as I said, I think if the artwork is a block, if it's a block for people, even some people lifting up their hearts to God, if it conjures up these notions, that a shrine shouldn't do that. A shrine needs to be a place of healing, of reconciliation, of pilgrimage. So to the extent that art becomes a stumbling block, we needed to really take a look at that. And that motivated the decision that we took.
There are some American Catholics who will learn about the scandal of Father Marco Rupnik from this decision today. And they might consider this another heartbreaking story, another stumbling block for the church that would pull them away in one way or another, another reason to walk away. What words do you have for those Catholics and for those considering the faith who will learn about this too?
I would say that those feelings are very understandable. Every Catholic has really been touched by this scandal that we've experienced in the church. So it's very understandable. I have been touched by this, right? It's a very difficult thing for all of us, for all Catholics. But I would say what the Knights are doing today and the decision we're taking is a sign of hope, right? It's a sign of hope. And so my message would be, don't let despair have the final word, right? There is hope. Your voice, those who are despairing, your voice matters, right? Your feelings matter. And Jesus is in his church, and he is there to bring healing and reconciliation. So I would say to those people, it's understandable, but pray to the Holy Spirit for guidance, pray for wisdom, which is something that I've done throughout this whole decision-making process, to pray for wisdom. But the Lord will be there for those who are close to despair.
You've talked about fatherhood a lot, especially in your role as the Supreme Knight, as a father. How did this decision affect you?
Well, you know, I think for every Catholic father, when you confront the reality of sexual abuse, it's a horrific thing. And for me as a father, I wanted to make the right decision for the future, and I want to protect my children and protect their innocence for as long as I can. And so I think the church is vigilant about this now, more so than ever. And it did weigh on me, because the Knights of Columbus is a family organization, and it weighed on me personally.
Well, I'm grateful for your candor and for your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Monsi.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, the European soccer final is right around the corner. And there are a couple of Catholic angles to Sunday's final in Berlin. Plus, a gathering in Germany to remember Pope Benedict XVI. Pope Francis recently met with a high-ranking member of the Russian Orthodox Church. Thursday's discussions at the Vatican marked the third time the Holy Father met with Metropolitan Anthony. No further details have emerged. The meeting came just days after Pope Francis expressed his sorrow over attacks on a children's hospital in Ukraine. A church leader in Mexico says he fears the country is on the path to communism. During his homily at a recent mass, Bishop Cristobal Asencio Garcia says his fears began after Mexico's election. The church leader asked for the faithful to pray that a Mexico in freedom and a Mexico capable of showing its faith and love may not be lost. The European Soccer Championship is Sunday in Berlin. The big match pits England against Spain, and a pregame ritual by Spain's coach is drawing attention. Luis de la Fuente says before every game, he makes the sign of the cross. In a recent interview, he said he does so because of faith and not superstition. The coach has weighed in on his faith several times, including saying that without God, his life would have no meaning. A player from Spain set to play a major role on Sunday also has a Catholic connection. Spain's Nico Williams is earning rave reviews for his performance. His parents are from Ghana. In search of a better life, his father and pregnant mother began a long journey to Europe. They soon found they were part of a human trafficking ring. And when they reached Spain, they were arrested. A Catholic priest and Caritas volunteer named Iñaki Mardones heard about the story and stepped in. He got the parents out of jail and helped the family settle in Spain. Now Nico and his older brother, the one his mother carried in her womb on the journey to Spain, are both soccer stars. The older brother is named Iñaki. Joining us now is Iñaki Mardones, the man who helped the Williams family all those years ago. Iñaki, thank you for being with us. Tell us a little bit more about how you met the family and the help that you provided them in getting settled in Spain.
Well, it started when their parents arrived in Bilbao. I worked in a Caritas group that supported immigrants, and since I knew English, I welcomed and received them. Their mother, whose name is Maria, arrived 8 months pregnant. When he was born, they asked me if I had any issues with them naming him after me. I told them that it was an honor, and because of that, we kept in contact those months they were in Bilbao. Then moved to a farm in Sesma, Navarra, and then moved to Pamplona, where Nico was born. We still keep in contact.
Do you think that their family story and this relationship with Caritas, going from Ghana to Spain, really affected them in their ability to persevere in something as difficult as professional athletics?
I think they have lived their faith very intensely. First, their parents trusted, lived, and gave them the gift of baptism and of the communion to their children, and they have lived accordingly. Once during a match, a spectator was not feeling very well, and Iñaki, the oldest, stayed with him praying until he got better. They have their faith very present, and it follows them in their lives.
Now, I can't let you go, Iñaki, without getting a prediction for Sunday. Who's going to win?
I hope and wish that Spain wins, but who knows?
Well, we'll be praying for that, Iñaki Mardones. Thank you so much. Finally tonight, a conference in Germany is honoring the life and legacy of Pope Benedict XVI. EWTN journalist Rudolf Gehrig has more.
A year and a half has passed since the death of Pope Benedict XVI. This week, theologians are meeting in the Bavarian town of Altötting, where Germany's most important Marian shrine is located, not far from Josef Ratzinger's birthplace, to discuss his enduring legacy.
I seen very well, because he was a very, very kind person. He was a person with a very deep faith. And he was a very intelligent theologian. And these three characteristics in one person is characteristic for Pope Benedict.
He always prayed, celebrated Mass every day, prayed the breviary. And so we wanted to reflect that also during the Congress, that there are times of prayer and times of discussion and times of conferences.
Both the organizers and the participants of the Benedict Forum are convinced that Benedict XVI still has a lot to teach us today.
I think his legacy is a deep theology that shows us that reason and faith are not opposed to each other, and that our intellect, our brain, our head, our heart, our soul, that they all belong together, and that we should search for the Lord, and that we should search for Jesus in all of this.
Even though Benedict XVI spent the last years of his life in seclusion as Pope Emeritus, people have not forgotten him. In Altötting, Rudolf Gehrig, EWTN News Nightly.
A beautiful tribute. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Montse Alvarado. Good night and God bless.